मशीन लगाऊंगा, इस साइड से आलू घुसेगा, उस साइड से सोना निकलेगा।
Welcome to this episode of the Attention Please podcast. This is your host, Arnab, and today we will be talking almost the full episode on the Bengal elections. So initially, I was planning to talk about the India-England Test Series, but the fact that there's, at the time of recording, a rally going on with Mithun Chakravarti and Narendra Modi has just totally moved every other topic out of my brain. And all that's left is Bengal politics. And I don't know what Mithun Chakravarti is going to say at that rally, whether he's officially going to, I mean, this is it's fairly obvious that he's going to join the BJP. I doubt he's going to stand there and give, 100 of his best dialogues. So that, I think, is fairly obvious at this point of time. What I don't know is whether he'll be announced as the chief ministerial candidate. Now, again, this is not something that the BJP usually does. I mean, it's done it in some places, but most famously in Uttar Pradesh, it did not announce a chief ministerial candidate. So I'm not sure. Maybe they won't do it now, especially because announcing a chief ministerial candidate has certain risks associated with it. And I'm not sure that I'm particularly sanguine as to whether their boots on the ground, like Dilip Ghosh, would particularly take it very well. So I think it's in BJP's best interests, given that they have done this before and given that they already have their own political icon in Modi, that they don't announce a chief ministerial candidate unless that chief ministerial candidate is sort of Ganguly, because then it's a totally different ballgame. Now, again, the time of recording, I don't know what's going on with that. It seems that Sourav Ganguly is going to be giving an exclusive interview to Arnab Goswami. Republic TV also launches on today. So today is a huge day at the time of recording. It's like battle stations in Bengal. As I tweeted that the siege of the fort of Bengal has begun. And once you have Mithun Chakravarti and Arnab Goswami, two of the biggest vuvuzelas that can conceivably launch against anybody. I mean, this is as serious as it gets. I mean, Arnab Goswami and Mithun Chakravarti together, I don't think any fort can withstand that assault. So it started today. I'm very curious as to how it goes. But I also saw right now, a few minutes ago, that Republic TV has an exclusive an interview with Sourav Ganguly. So again, I don't know what's going on there. Obviously, nothing here is to quote a famous Abbas Mastan movie, everything happens according to a plan. So I don't think that there's anything which is happening just like that. So I think there is some kind of synchronization here, especially when it's Republic TV, which, let's be honest, is the BJP's official channel. So I'm not sure where this is going, whether Ganguly is going to announce his joining the BJP on Arnab Goswami's show, which I would be a little surprised if he does, because given his stature and given his ambition, if he's going to go in, he has to go in as their chief ministerial candidate. And for that to happen, he needs to be inducted into the party by Narendra Modi. Now, it could be that he's going to appear at the Modi rally. Maybe that's the surprise. I don't know at this time of speaking. It's a little... I wish that I had recorded this later, because then I would know what's going on. But it's also a little exciting because you don't know. You don't know where things are going to go. So I can speculate endlessly and let my imagination roam. So I don't know what's going on here. I don't think anybody does. But the fact that Ganguly has chosen today to also give the interview to Arnab Goswami, I'm pretty sure the interview has been pre-recorded, but the fact that it is playing today, it's not only a grand opening for Republic TV, but also might be politically significant. So let's structure this discussion. And we've spoken, and I've written a lot about Bengal politics over the years. I've spoken a lot about it. So there's always this, like, maybe I'm repeating myself here, but sometimes it's not bad to repeat myself, and sometimes it's good to repeat yourself in a different way, as anybody who's taught knows. So let's look at the whole thing about Bengal elections from a slightly different perspective than we've normally looked at it. So let's look at the three essentially parties that are in the fray. So one, I would say, is the Congress, CPM combined. It's almost ridiculous for anybody who grew up in the 80s and the 90s to think of these two political parties allied together in Bengal. But such has been the revolution in Bengal politics that these once strange bedfellows have kind of forged an alliance with each other. And of course, when you have Pirzada Abbas Siddiqui joining them, it says something for the Communist Party of Bengal that the people who swore that religion was the opium of the masses are openly ally with a Muslim cleric, a pretty provocative one, as also not just a Muslim cleric. So it's fairly evident. And again, it for the CPM and Congress, in a way, it makes sense because they have, they're basically like the batsman who goes in when there are 50 runs to get and there are three balls left. So what are they going to do? So they can either just punt and, go back to the pavilion undefeated, or they could just basically swing for the hills. And right now they're swinging for the hills, which makes sense. And also because there's another game that I think it would be their best way forward. It is for both the BJP, and this I believe is perhaps is quite likely that none of them might be able to form a government by themselves, at which point of time they would need the help of the CPM and the Congress. And it's fairly obvious. And again, the thing with is that since the Congress and the CPM cannot join BJP, it kind of reduces their bargaining leverage with Trinamool Congress. Should the situation be that the Trinamool Congress needs support of other parties to form the government. So in any ways, that is their best bet. Their best bet would be to play the kingmaker, because they obviously none of them can cobble together enough seats to form the government of their own. It's fairly obvious. So again, somebody who grew up in the 80s and 90s even saying this, I can almost see my 20-year-old self looking through the space-time continuum at me and saying, "What ki bolcho? Ki bolcho onobda?" And by the way, I might switch to Bengali sometimes because it's very difficult to talk about Bengal politics in English. It's very difficult to even think of an Onubroto or Madan Moitro and still talk in the colonial's own tongue, because it's a very Bengali, unfortunately. So, and I know that it won't translate outside Bengal, which is why I'm talking in English. And I also realize that the real audience for this is going to be people who are not Bengalis, people who are not as deeply submerged into the politics and culture of Bengal as most Bengalis are, who possibly would hearing this is saying that he's not saying anything particularly new or novel or something that we don't intrinsically know. Anyways, so how has the CPM, I mean, the Congress, of course, I mean, it's worthless, it's pretty useless talking about them, but what led to the CPM getting to where they are currently? There was an interesting interview that I saw with Dilip Ghosh on ABP Anand, where it's a great interview, actually, in terms of, and I think I'll come to that when I'm talking about Dilip Ghosh, but it was the first time that I got to see it. I've seen Dilip Ghosh usually in like 30-second or 45-second clips, and that was pretty much all that I could tolerate. And so mercifully, it was less than a minute of Dilip Ghosh at a time. But this was like the first time which I had like 45 minutes of Dilip Ghosh, and he actually came off quite well, I would say. He didn't come off as the person who normally comes off in his rallies or in his speech. He came off as a very pragmatic, realistic person, not particularly somebody who's saying that, look, we have principles and we have ideology and we have a policy. He doesn't care about any of that. He's a foot soldier, and all he cares for is winning. He's the kind of guy who in corporate world, he's a salesman. I mean, he doesn't care how he makes a sale. He has a target and he wants to meet it. And he's willing to do whatever it takes in order to meet that target. So that's really what politics is. And anybody who comes and says politics is different and I want to do politics in a different way, like a certain Arvind Kejriwal, you know from the moment his mouth opens that the guy is a charlatan. This guy doesn't even come across like that. What he said was honest and it was real politics. And you could say that it was morally ambiguous, but that's what politics is. That's always been a problem with democratic politics. It's never going to be, it's never going to be, you know, and that's why many people don't want to go into politics, is that there's always a strong moral compromise that you have to make. Anyways, I'm kind of going off track, but that might happen in the course of this conversation. I might be diverted and I'll try to come back. So let's talk about a little bit about the Communist Party of India. And it's not just, this is not just a discussion of the history. This is very relevant to understanding Bengal politics of today and who will ultimately perhaps go on to win this assembly election. So for about 30 years, the Communist Party of India built inside Bengal the most amazing structure. It was, of course, amazing from their point of view, in that it was it aligned perfectly with their goals. It was, of course, terrible for Bengal because it took one of India's most prosperous and advanced states, and it just basically sapped all the vitality from it, which is what socialism and communism does at any place. It is nothing more than a kind of administrative cancer. And the Communist Party of India, CPM, were very good executors of the communist model. But for their perspective, it was fairly good, because what they did was they essentially created a pyramid structure. So, and I've said this before, the difference between Congress corruption and CPM corruption was that Congress corruption, the top guys took everything and let the bottom guys stay with nothing. So they fought and they went to the other side. This is exactly what's happened to the Congress Party nationally. That's why, in a nutshell, the Congress Party is in that moribund state that it is today, because of precisely that. Now, the CPM, being a cadre-based party, never quite did that. So they kind of spread the wealth around. So money, let's just say the fruits of power kind of flowed down in a pyramid structure. So everybody got something. And so everybody was kind of invested in the system and that politics. That's why the CPM just could not be elected out. They also used to use rather questionable means to win elections. But even if they didn't, they would win. Maybe they wouldn't win by that overwhelming a margin, but they would still win, even if the elections were free and fair in the 80s without any intimidation. They would still win. They would still win in the rural areas. They might lost a few in Calcutta. But the fact that they created this structure where, at the panchayat level, whether it was the panchayats, whether it was the, the community clubs in Calcutta, whether it were in Calcutta as well as in the district capitals, which are smaller cities, whether they were in the teachers' union, whether they were in the banks, whether they were in the jute mills, any place which had a few people, the CPM would unionize it. From the mishtir dokan, from the sweet shop, even they had unions. So everybody had a union and a traders' organization, and all of them were infiltrated by the CPM. All of them essentially sucked the blood out of whoever they claim to be representing. And of course, something like this initially works because they always start with something, right? So there's a lot of blood to suck. But as the years go by, and the number of, and this is what happens within any communist and socialist system, is that ultimately the producers, they leave. They either die, get killed, they migrate, or they just stop producing. There is no incentive to. And the number of the number of blood sucking leeches, they keep on increasing, and the engorged blood filled organisms that they need to feed off, they start dying. So that's exactly what happened with the CPM over the years. So even though the structure stayed, the monster stayed as it was, the vitality started sucking itself out. And naturally, it was not anything wrong with the structure. This was inevitable. This was going to happen. If there are limited resources and there is nothing new coming up, then obviously at some point of time, it's going to get, you know, it's like the total amount of petroleum in the world. It's going to go out. It's going to run out. It's a finite resource. So over the years, that's really what happened to the CPM. Now, with the communists, there were some things that the communists in those days still couldn't touch. The one thing that they couldn't touch was the religious groups and communities. So because the CPM were, at least nominally, they followed the philosophy of Marx and Lenin, and that religion was an opium of the masses, they could not be very close to, in classically, and again, this thing, obviously, this got loosened over the years. But if you look at the old traditional Bengal Marxists, the one who really laid the foundation for the CPM structure that endured for more than, you know, almost 30-odd years. So if you look at them, the only people that they kind of hesitated to align with were the radical Islamic clerics who were sprouting up in the rural areas of Bengal. And they were sprouting up primarily because of migration from Bangladesh, unchecked migration from Bangladesh, which, by the way, is a lot less now, a lot less now. It used to be a lot more. And again, this is not, many people like to say, this is a canard which is spread by, you know, right-wing Hindutva forces. No, actually, the biggest protester against this was Mamata Banerjee at one point of time, when she felt that, you know, these people were benefiting the CPM. So it's not just, you know, an evil right-wing conspiracy. This was Mamata Banerjee's stated stance throughout for many years, that the CPM is basically, they're leaving the borders open so that they can cultivate their vote bank. So anyways, but over the years, there was a huge profusion of madrasas which came up, and the communal nature of them was pointed out by none other than Buddhadev Bhattacharya, who then went on to become the chief minister, and Jyoti Basu at that time silenced him. You know, he was silenced because he was concerned about the growing communalism and the growing kind of identity politics that was coming up in Bengal. And he protested against that because Buddhadev Babu was, you know, no matter, you know, how you evaluate him as a chief minister, one of the things about him was he believed in a few principles and he stood true to them throughout his life. He's a very rare politician in that respect, that he's honest, upright, totally non-corrupt. Everybody knows him, that he didn't make anything from his years as a chief minister. And, you know, no matter what you think about his beliefs, the thing was that he's that rarity in that he stands true to his beliefs, irrespective of the consequence of that. So he once had a major falling out with Jyoti Basu based on, you know, the cozy relationship that the communists had with the real estate developers. So he had, you know, publicly gone public and said, you know, he didn't approve of this. Again, he fell out with the party because ultimately the party was, you know, getting their stuff from somewhere. So it was obviously real estate when that's the only business that really booms when you're not really producing anything. It's still real estate. I mean, there are more people. You know, people are reproducing, there are more people, they need a place to stay. So real estate is always there. It is in a way function, but it's not that directly a function of productivity. But industry and everything had left, thanks to Jyoti Basu and thanks to his minions. But this superstructure that they created, the only thing that they could not reach out to was that. And this was, and they realized what a terrible mistake it had been when the Nondigram, when the whole Nondigram thing started. And that was when, because the Nondigram in that place is almost like 30% Muslim and they're very organized. And the communists just didn't have any leeway there. Now, who were the opponents of the communists? The communists had no opposition. So one was Mamata Banerjee. You know, she was persistently a thorn in their flesh throughout the 90s. And she was absolutely uncompromising. While the Congress, I mean, but she was originally part of the Congress, as many of you may know, but most of her, you know, colleagues in the Congress were, you know, they were called watermelons. So they were basically green on the outside and red inside. So they were all basically double agents of the CPM, in the sense that the CPM would let them, you know, have their own little fiefdoms where their writ ran large, and that they could take hafta from the vendors and the street sellers, and the CPM didn't interfere. But as long as they stayed within their areas, the CPM were fine with them. So they knew that this was their ilaka. They didn't go out of it, and they, you know, they would make some noises, but they would never really get, you know, they knew what lines they can't cross with the CPM. Mamata Banerjee was the only person who had no line, who had no filter. You would be at the communists throughout without any kind of compromise. That's, you have to give that to her. She's not, you know, she's, I mean, no matter what you might have, you know, no matter what you might think of her as an administrator or as a poet or as an artist, there's one thing that she's very uncompromising about, or used to be, which was, you know, her opposition to them. I mean, if she opposes you, she opposes you. She's not going to compromise. And that the BJP now knows. Anyways, so what Mamata Banerjee did, and this was, so, oh, and there was another thing. So the one opposition to this Marxist CPM was Mamata Banerjee, and the other was what they used to call Maoists. So Maoists were essentially, this is a generic term to denote basically independent bands of gundas who were not aligned with this, with the CPM. That's this generic catch-all term. So these could be anybody. They could be disgruntled CPM chieftains because somebody else had been favored. They could be people trying to grab their land back. They could be anybody. And they were all generically tagged as Maoists. Now, when Nandigram started, the way they communicated it was that it's basically Maoists who are, so there's development going on there, and it's being opposed by Maoists. And what did the CPM do? The CPM used one of their strongmen by the name of Lakshman Seth to suppress Nandigram. And it was terrible. So Lakshman Seth, together with the police force, in a way, there was no distinction between them. And that was really Buddhadev Babu's biggest failure, that despite his good intentions, he could never, you know, move, maybe it's not possible, the Communist Party away from its culture of violence and its culture of using state institutions to further state terror. He couldn't do that. So he tried to, but when push came to shove, he just went back to that. And so he used Lakshman Seth, and I don't know whether he used or, you know, somebody else used, and he didn't protest. In a way, it doesn't matter. He was the chief minister. It was his responsibility. So, so this was what, you know, the Nandigram, ultimately it was a guy called Shubhendu Adhikari. We're going to talk about him within a few minutes. So he, Mamata Banerjee, they used the power of the local Muslim community, which again at the CPM had refused to kind of touch in an organized way, as well as the quote-unquote Maoists. In those days, Mamata Banerjee had gone on public record saying there are no Maoists in Bengal. This is all a CPM chakranto conspiracy. After she became a chief minister, and as all of you knew, one of her favorite ways of addressing her opponents was, "I'm sorry, you are Maoist." So the Maoists appeared right after she became the chief minister, because again, the Maoists are essentially in Bengal. It's a term used to denote anybody who's using violence to attain their aims, but are not aligned with any political party. So that's really the real definition of a Maoist. And some of them could actually be Maoists, but it doesn't necessarily mean that all of them are Maoists. So the CPM basically lost because of that. So Mamata Banerjee was able to cobble together a coalition of quote-unquote Maoists, which were really independent, disgruntled members of the ruling class. And when I say ruling class, don't think of, you know, people who are in Calcutta. There are, you know, cities and villages. So people who are like the defeated Gram Panchayat guy, you know, somebody who's disgruntled that the local CPM goon has taken over his land. It could be anybody. So she basically took those disgruntled elements, who were as violent, of course, because they were also part of the CPM at some point of time. And these things are important, because this is exactly what the BJP is now doing to the Trinamool Congress, by the way. So the formula they're using is the exact same formula. And the reason why it's the same formula is because it was formulated by the same guy, a guy by the name of Mukul Rai. So they took this and they used the whole, and this was again one of the fundamental new things that Mamata Banerjee brought to Bengal politics, which was she brought the religion aspect of it. This was never really a part of Bengal politics before. Growing up, religion was not, and that was one of the main reasons why the BJP, nobody could even think of BJP in Bengal, because BJP's main DNA was religion. And in Bengal, even though Bengal had seen tremendous amount of communal bloodshed during the partition, in politics, religion was religion, caste, these things were not important at all. It was honestly, that was true. So Mamata Banerjee in this, the third thing that Mamata Banerjee did, and which again, Bengal politics, whether it was Congress or CPM, was ultimately in the hands of very privileged Western educated men. So there were certain lines they didn't cross. There were certain people they didn't interact with. There were certain things that they couldn't say. So in those days, there was a, and this is a part of the hypocrisy of the Bengal educated class, that they, you know, there is definitely some kind of inbuilt classism. So the easiest way to understand is there are two words. One is Bhadralok, which is a gentleman, and one is the Chotolok, which is a technically translated to small man or little man. This has got nothing to do with caste or anything. It doesn't matter which caste or which religion the Bhadralok and the Chotolok is. The Bhadralok is the guy who can talk impeccably in Bengali English, who has a college education, and the Chotolok is the person who doesn't. And the CPM had, the Communist Party of India had a kind of two-level thing. There were the guys who you know talked about Marxist literature and talked about the French communists. And then there were the guys who actually went and did the speeches, and they were vulgar and uncouth. And then the leader of them was a guy called Subhash Chakraborty, who had his own chief, but nobody thought that Subhash Chakraborty would ever be the chief minister. It was presumed that there was always going to be the individual contributors and the managers. And the managers were Jyoti Basu and Buddhadev and, that gang. And then there were the guys who on election day, they stood and made sure that votes fell where they should. They were the guys who mobilized people. They were the guys who stood on the dais and said whatever they could, like vulgar, filthy language. And if you've ever heard, and people sometimes get shocked that the violence of Bengal, well, Bengal is, no matter what you might think of Bengal, it is an extremely violent place. Violent, not just in terms of physical violence, which it is. It's also extremely violent and crude place in terms of the language that people use politically. You'd be surprised at the kind of, the kind of stereotype that of the Bengal as the, as the soft-spoken, the soft-spoken, gentle intellectual. It's actually just that, a stereotype. So once you hit the, for those of you who remember that whole Tapas Pal incident, Tapas Pal, the only thing was Tapas Pal didn't know that he was being recorded. In those days, it was early days of cell phone, and he just couldn't wrap his mind around that whatever he says, there's somebody nowadays records. So what he was doing was pretty standard for those days in terms of, every political party did that. That's the level of speech that's usually engaged in. And this is from CPM days. So the reason why he was saying this is exactly what he grew up listening to. So again, the reason why I'm going over the history is not only for us to understand why the CPM, but is also to understand the current strategy that the BJP has adopted, because they're basically using the same thing against Mamata Banerjee. This is really the only thing that works. Now, in the BJP's case, it's a little, why I'm a little less sure of it is because Mamata Banerjee actually, she kept on hammering at the CPM edifice for more than 20 to 30 years. So she spent a lot of time, and it took a lot of time to work her way into the system, to selectively kind of gouge out certain weak parts of their scaffolding. I mean, it took a lot of time for her to, infiltrate the CPM fort. And she, many times she couldn't, she lost. She took, five steps forward and took 10 steps back. So it took her a lot of time to get into the organization. But once she did, and Nandigram and Singur were the turning points, as in any battle, that in any war, there are these turning battles. After that, what she did was she basically took the entire CPM superstructure and she just put her, she put a ring on it. She put her own name on it. And so people had no choice. Either the CPM, the old CPM party, many of them joined Trinamool Congress. Both CPM as well as Congress, they joined Trinamool Congress. So that's one. Those who didn't join basically found themselves out of politics through intimidation. And third, some of them just, you know, joined, were neglected, but then they, you know, they nursed a grudge. Now, this, all of this, while all of this was happening, Mamata Banerjee was one of the things about, one of the good things about Mamata Banerjee, she was always seen as a person of the people, as in contrast to Buddhadev, as in contrast to Jyoti Basu. He was actually initially, you know, kind of was able to masquerade himself as a man of the people once, but, you know, that veneer kind of fell off pretty quickly. But Mamata Banerjee's main thing about her is she's a very approachable, down-to-earth person. You know, as anybody who's talked to Mamata Banerjee, and despite how she sometimes comes across, is that universally people say, you know, she's a person with a great amount of empathy for people, and, you know, she really cares for people, and, you know, she's able to make that personal connect with people that, you know, that good politicians are able to do. This is again an ability that none of the communist leaders had. And this is I don't think a lot of politicians have to the extent that Mamata Banerjee does. This is really her single biggest strength, and that's why she's managed to sustain for so long. And that's why she was managed to sustain, you know, almost 30 years of being in the wilderness, purely because she had this quality about her. So when she came to power, you know, she used the same CPM techniques as I said when she came to power. This is nothing, but there's no Porivarton. This is just the old Communist Party under different management. And that's exactly, it was physically true because they were the exact same people also. So she just took that whole structure. She kind of cemented up the places where she had broken through. I mean, she had done it herself, so she kind of cemented it. And she made another, you know, she made a fairly, you know, rigid structure, and, you know, she supplanted the CPM. Till, of course, now we have reached the place where Mamata Banerjee has taken a number of missteps that has led her to where she is right now, where you have essentially the enemy is at the gate. Now, how did this happen, and what is the way forward? So this is a long-winded way of coming here. So what is the prospect of Trinamool Congress? So we talked about the CPM and the Congress. To summarize, their only end game is for there to be a hung assembly and for them to be kingmakers. Now, for Trinamool Congress, they've had, their main problem started with, of course, the Sharoda and the Rose Valley and the different kind of corruption scams. Now, to be realistic, and actually Dilip Ghosh actually mentions that in the interview, that corruption is never really an issue in politics in India. And also in terms of the sheer, and you can say, well, if that is true, then how did the UPA government get voted out? Well, the UPA government got voted out because of the scale of their corruption. You know, unlike, you know, social media warriors, the people who actually voted are actually very pragmatic when it comes to corruption. Everybody knows that sab leta hai. If they didn't take, then they wouldn't be in politics. Why do people struggle? I mean, why do people fight like this to get elected? I mean, everybody knows it's not to serve you, it's to serve themselves. So obviously it needs to be, people are willing to walk for miles. They're willing to get having stones thrown at them. They're willing to brave lathis be, you know, they could die. So when somebody puts in this amount of risk, it obviously has to be enough amount of benefit for this, right? In order for this risk to be worth it. It's not just one crazy person doing it. It's the whole group of people who are doing it consistently. So that means that there is risk and there is also a payoff. There's a payoff which makes the risk worth it. Otherwise, this would not be sustaining. There would be nobody who wanted to get elected. And elections would meet the fate of Blockbuster and travel agents. That never happens, right? Anywhere in the world. So there's obviously money to be made. So the main problem with Trinamool wasn't really the Rose Valley and Sharoda. I mean, there were scams, there were scandals. And even if you look at the sheer amount of money involved, it was pretty okay, I would say. I mean, again, it might be a severe indictment of how, of the scale of things in Bengal. And in Bengal, movies budgets are low, you know, industrial output is low. So obviously corruption is also low in that, with respect to that, because it's just, there's just nothing to go around, even the money for corruption. But whatever it is, it's not so much the magnitude of the corruption itself. I'm pretty sure that these wouldn't have been an election issue otherwise, enough for Mamata Banerjee to really feel scared of whether she's going to come back as a chief minister. But it's the pressure that was exerted on individuals, so again, let me take a step back. So with Mamata Banerjee, the thing was that Mamata Banerjee was the face of the party. And because this is a political party in which does not really have any ideological core, unlike the Marxists, who can at least go and refer to, and the BJP also has a strong ideological core. They have a very strong ideological core. The Marxists have a strong ideological core. Trinamool Congress has no ideological core at all. This is the exact same problem that the Congress has. There is no ideological core. So how do you keep people invested in the party? Well, one way is, what are you getting out of the party? You know, what are your creature comforts? And that can only go so far, because ultimately, you know, there's always going to be some political party which will offer you more of those creature comforts. So Trinamool Congress was unable to create, and it was very late then they kind of tried to create a, you know, a Bengali nationalism kind of thing. You know, we are Bengalis, they're outsiders. That was too late in the game. Instead, what Mamata Banerjee kind of, to her detriment, I would say, tried to keep on doing was she tried to communalize, especially, you know, in terms of minority appeasement. She went way too far. And I'm not getting into the morality of this, but as a political strategy, I think her strategy was that if I get like 30% of this vote, I mean, I think this her thinking was, who's likely to be my primary enemy? It's going to be BJP maybe someday. So all that I need to do is and the BJP is not going to get Muslim votes, period. So all I need to do is I need to consolidate all the Muslim votes. If I get assured 30%, I'm going to win. And of course, I'm going to get some Hindu votes. So I'm kind of safe. So that's really what I think the calculus that was going on in her mind. However, what happened was that somewhere, this level of pandering became so much that even in Bengal, which is traditionally an extremely tolerant place, people started to take notice of this, that, you know, how come so much, you know, government funding is going to, you know, dargahs and madrasas and, you know, and later on when she realized her mistake, she kind of pivoted and then started giving the same amount of money to goshalas and to Hindu priests. But by that time, the damage had been done, really. The answer isn't to give, you know, religions money. The answer is to give no religion money. And this is the problem this is the road that she went down on. But once she had already done that, it didn't matter how much money she gave, because the perception had already been created. And the BJP just rammed in at that point of time. This was exactly what they were waiting for. And combined with the fact that also, and this is perhaps another important thing, is that the problem with, let's look at the Congress Party. What is the major problem with the Congress Party? The major problem with the Congress Party is that it's a party which believes in nothing except the fact that that somebody with the name Gandhi or Nehru should rule. Now, even this would work if the Gandhis and the Nehrus were not so insecure that they didn't allow a second line of leaders. See, this is the problem with the Congress, you know, whether it be in Assam or whether it be Telangana, whenever there's any powerful Congress guy who comes up, they basically work towards, you know, weakening that person. It started with Netaji Subhash Chandra Bose, honestly. So this is part of Congress culture. Anybody who comes up, who they feel is locally very powerful, even though this person is a Congress person, but doesn't like kind of bend their knee to, you know, the Gandhi or Nehru family, they get rid of the guy. They just kick him out. So this is what actually ultimately has led to the absolute decimation of Congress, because this is part of the Congress culture. It's a culture which punishes successful people. And it happens to this day. It's a culture because they are afraid that they will outshine Rahul Gandhi. And it's so easy to outshine Rahul Gandhi. I mean, let's be honest. So there's no hope for anybody with who's a little bit more than average. So that's why Congress, whoever is in Congress now, they're very average leaders, most of them. I mean, they're Surjewala levels. I mean, Surjewala, I think, is the typical Congress guy. I mean, can anybody think of Surjewala being a prime minister or, you know, being a leader? No, they can't. And that's exactly the kind of people Congress wants. This is exactly the problem with Trinamool Congress also. And this happened because of the fact that Trinamool Congress was absolutely not interested in creating another line of leaders. Now, BJP does have another line of leaders. Now, BJP, to be honest, has kind of moving towards that single person Modi thing. This was not really the DNA of the BJP, let's say 10 years ago. BJP was always led by committee. So there was, of course, a figurehead. There was obviously somebody who's a public facing, like a Vajpayee or an Advani, but there was still a number of people who were well-known second rung, not first rung, but second rung, but powerful people. And this is what any political party requires in order to be robust and sustainable. Now, the BJP still has that because ultimately the RSS forms that backup so that, you know, there is still kind of a balance of power because RSS forms a silent, a rein on, you know, some of their aspirations. So it does exist. Also, the fact is, even today, if you look at the BJP, if you look, there is Modi, there is Shah, and then there is Yogi. So there is still a number of alternatives to a Modi. And it is true that, and I think this will come to bite BJP later on, is that the BJP is actually whittling down on one of its biggest strengths, which was its bench strength, really. Now, the Trinamool Congress has never, it works exactly in that Gandhi family principle. They don't want a second bench. They don't want anybody who is, there's only Mamata Banerjee's face on any political poster. That's it. Nobody else's face is there. Now, this was okay with everybody. In a way, everybody who was in Trinamool Congress, they felt like the Shubhendu Adhikaris of Nandigram, they felt that they owed their career to Mamata Banerjee. They knew that by ourselves, we could never have uprooted the CPM. The reason why we are even here is because of Mamata Banerjee. So there was this, okay, and so she wants to put her face on everything. That's perfectly fine. So there was that. So there was that understanding. And that's why Congress also, till there was Nehru and there was Indira Gandhi, people kind of still felt that, you know, without these guys, we are really nobodies. So, but now they realize that Rahul Gandhi, of course, we'd be far better off without him. We would be far better off without Sonia Gandhi or Robert Vadra. But this was not the case. This was not the case of the Congress in the 60s and the 70s. So that's why the Congress was, there was still a thing in the 60s and 70s until the 80s. But with Trinamool Congress, then the problem started with the ascension of Mamata Banerjee's nephew, Abhishek Banerjee. Now you find that on every poster, there's a picture of Mamata Banerjee and a picture of Abhishek Banerjee as the next in line to take over. Now, this was a problem for many of the chieftains. While they were perfectly okay with Mamata Banerjee, they were not okay with Abhishek Banerjee, because Abhishek Banerjee had done nothing. He's no different from Rahul Gandhi or from Aditya Thackeray. It's a very similar profile. These are, again, you know, and you know, the kind of people who are entitled scions who are born to rule, and they have not been part of any of the struggles that Mamata Banerjee had. So all the goodwill that Mamata, so if you hear Bengal politics, and I was listening right before recording, everybody, you know, all these renegade Trinamool Congress rank and file who had joined the BJP, all of them were saying PCR Bhaipo, which means aunt and nephew, that they are going to get defeated. The Bhaipo kept coming in. So this was basically, the Trinamool Congress was now made up of two people. And the second person was somebody who's universally not respected within the party, because that person has nothing, has not achieved anything, has not contributed to the political party in any shape or form. And justifiably, there were other people who had done much more for the political party, not as much as Mamata Banerjee. That's why they have no problems with Mamata Banerjee.
But definitely after Mamata Banerjee, they had done a lot. Somebody like Shubhendu Adhikari, who was really the person who actually led the whole Nandigram, struggle was actually led by him. And of course, Mamata Banerjee was the figurehead. And of course, Mamata Banerjee capitalized on it. But ultimately, it was him. So if there was any second rung that was being created, if there was any succession planning that was being done, he had to be a part of it. So it was not just him. A lot of people felt that, you know, ultimately all the decision was being going was going to Abhishek and Banerjee, as well as, you know, somebody like Prashant Kishore, who was, you know, again, this kind of a, you know, he works with everybody. He's an electoral consultant. He has no idea of what the ground force of what happens on the ground. You know, there's severe doubts as to how much he even knows as to what he says. So this whole notion of consultants and, you know, the party kind of moved away from its real core strength, which is street politics. And Mamata Banerjee's own personal charisma, she basically became a figurehead. She spends most of her time either in national politics, you know, meeting with Arvind Kejriwal. She's not there on the ground talking to people. So she's kind of moved on to national politics. And also, you know, her obsession with, you know, establishing herself as an intellectual and as the next Rabindranath Tagore. And, you know, and in her association with movie stars, and, you know, she really loves surrounding herself with different kinds of movie stars. So all of that has kind of separated her from really where her base is. And I think this is coming right now. This is what the BJP has capitalized. So whether it be Mukul, and, you know, Mukul Roy, he was humiliated as the railway minister. You know, this is, again, the autocratic nature of Mamata Banerjee. So Mamata Banerjee is now being a lot of people who are now coming, you know, who are coming kind of standing up against Mamata Banerjee, all people she had at some point of the time, you know, humiliated. And she's very autocratic in the way that it's, let's say, in Indira Gandhi was. There's no difference. But, you know, these people at that point of time, they just took it because there was nothing that they could do. But now with Abhishek Banerjee, and the reason why people take it is because I might be pissed, but the next guy isn't pissed because there's nothing that's happened to him. But now, Abhishek Banerjee has pissed off a sufficient number of people that they can now form their own group and then leverage that connection with BJP. And the BJP has been watching. They're very smart. They've been watching what has been going on, and they have been like gloating, waiting for the Trinamool Congress's second rung to basically fall in on itself. And that's exactly what's happened. Now what's happened is Mamata Banerjee is basically facing her own political party, which has rebranded itself the BJP. So, of course, there are people like Dilip Ghosh who were never part of the Trinamool Congress. But most of the brains behind BJP, whether it be Shubhendu or whether it be Mukul Roy, they're all, you know, renegade Trinamool Congress. And they know exactly what tricks to play. They've played it. They have seen the actual tactics that Mamata Banerjee has used. So now, this time, the BJP has a serious game. Before that, they were never serious about winning in Bengal. They were coming in with like Bapi Lahiri. Of course, they were not going to win anything. But now they're coming with people who have the exact same boots on the ground experience that Mamata Banerjee had. They know what exactly she did. It was like a, you know, it's basically like a company, you know, absorbing another company where they just basically hired their core technical team. They just take them. They just give them higher salaries and take them and ask them to, you know, those guys might have the patents, but just who knows? Who cares about the patents? Just redo it for us again. And that's really what the BJP has done at this point of time. And with, you know, somebody like Mithun Chakravarti, how important are these? Now let's come to Sourav Ganguly, which is what I want to conclude with. So one of the things that I've always felt that the BJP kind of lacks is it has lacked a kind of personality to put up against Mamata Banerjee. Because I think that in Bengal, the kind of people we are, we need personalities. We are a very emotional lot, and even more emotional than the usual Indian. And in order for us, and the only way that Mamata Banerjee can get herself out of this is because through emotion, that many people might still vote for her because of the emotional connect they feel with her. That might be what tips it in her favor.
But so which always I've always wondered as to who the BJP would put up again. Now, Dilip Ghosh is, you know, is the problem with putting up somebody who's not Dilip Ghosh is that it pisses Dilip Ghosh off. And this is the last, this is these few months, BJP cannot afford to piss off Dilip Ghosh because he is their on the ground leader. I mean, he's the guy who goes up brick against brick, rod against rod, stone against stone. He's that guy. Okay. So he's not particularly erudite. He's, again, in Bengal, there is another big thing that our expectation of our leaders is that our leader has to be a, you know, that Bhadralok thing. That's still there. And this is why Mamata Banerjee has to invent that, you know, that PhD, the artist, the Renaissance person, you know, because she has to invent that because she doesn't have it. Because this is a very unique thing about Bengal politics is that the leader has to be an intellectual. That's an expectation. And that's not just an expectation of the of Calcutta elite. That's pretty much a universal expectation. And that's why Mamata Banerjee had to kind of manufacture that reality. Now, with Dilip Ghosh, that's a little problematic. So that's going to be his biggest problem. The other thing is, you know, to go with, I don't know, Mithun Chakravarty. Again, the problem with Mithun Chakravarty, again, is that Mithun Chakravarty, despite what, you know, I'm a huge fan, but he's not also going to be taken particularly seriously, even though he has, he's a multiple national award winner, an amazing actor. The thing is that also because of, you know, the kind of movies that most people associate him with the Gunda type of movies, he doesn't have that intellectual heft, which he otherwise would have if he just hadn't done those movies. So I don't know what the deal with Mithun Chakravarty is. Again, he's been a person who's been associated. He started off his life as a hardcore Naxalite, went to Bombay because he was afraid of being shot by the police here. He was that an active a Naxalite. So he's gone from absolute left now to absolute right there. You know, in Bombay, he was pretty close to Bal Thackeray and to Shiv Sena. Then he came back, joined Trinamool Congress, then resigned from Trinamool Congress. Now he's thinking, so he's, you know, he's gone everywhere. And, you know, as I said, he's a really versatile actor and he acts in different kinds of movies and for different kinds of political parties. So I don't know what the end game with him is. And I'm not particularly confident that it should be. This is my personal opinion. It's not worth the BJP's risk to make him the chief ministerial face, knowing fully well that this might not be taken well by, let's say, Dilip Ghosh, by the rank and file. And as it is, it's already happening. For instance, if you look at like Rupa Ganguly and, you know, some of the other people who have kind of been with the party for a long time, I don't think that they're getting the prominence that they feel they should. And more of the renegade Trinamool Congress crowd is getting that. And even, and though they have not been, then they, it's not that they literally joined the party 24 hours ago, like somebody like Ashok Dinda, for instance, or Manoj Tiwari. These people are still like a year or so old, so they don't have. And see, that's one of the biggest problems with the BJP. It's like any IPL team which just buys new players off the rack. They never win initially, right? It takes some time for a team to kind of gel together. The thing with Trinamool is that it still has a sufficient number of people. I mean, of course, they have lost a lot, but they still have a core group which can cobble together something. And they do have an Anubroto. They do have people. It's not that they don't. And these people have been on the ground for years and decades, and they know how the system works. So it's a tough battle. I mean, perhaps it's going to be split. I don't know. I really don't know how this is going to play out. But I think it would be a mistake to make Mithun Chakravarty the chief ministerial candidate, because I don't think the BJP gains much from it. I think the BJP stands to lose a lot because you see, people are joining BJP now just because of what they can get out of it. Because with Trinamool, all the seats have been taken. Because the Trinamool has lost a lot of people, now they have again cast their net wide, and all that they can get are essentially, you know, influencers from the Bengali movie industry. And they do that for two reasons. Firstly, because Mamata Banerjee loves famous people. She loves, you know, associating with famous people. That's one reason. So I think this is not a political thing. And in Trinamool Congress, there is no strategy. Ultimately, Mamata Banerjee wants, Mamata Banerjee gets. And the second thing is there is an element of strategy is that when you've basically done very little
you know, ultimately it's like influential Instagram influencer marketing. I mean, the influencer at least gets people to show up at the rally. Now, whether the vote or not is something else. There's really nothing you can do. But if you just put somebody who nobody knows, then, you know, it's, you've lost the game from day one. So I think that it doesn't really make sense for the BJP to go with Mithun Chakraborty as their face. With Sourav Ganguly is different. And this is why I'm so intrigued with what happened with Sourav Ganguly. Because, you know, Sourav Ganguly joined the base, made the chief of BCCI with Amit Shah's son. I mean, I always looked at it as some kind of audition that Sourav Ganguly was doing. It was both a way for Sourav Ganguly to gauge whether he could work with the BJP, and it was also a way for the BJP to gauge his bona fides. And I think this was, I honestly never felt that Sourav Ganguly wanted to lead the BCCI. He's an extremely ambitious guy, and I think this is too small for where I believe he wants to be. I think, knowing him in the sense, you know, I don't know him personally, but my understanding that, you know, where he comes from and how his mind works, his next step is being the chief minister of West Bengal or prime minister of India. That's really where he's targeting. And in a way, the captain of India cricket team is at that level. The captain of Indian cricket team is, in terms of importance and popularity, not much below the prime minister of India, I would say. And that's really what he's pegged at. So I always felt that this BCCI thing was a sham. It was a cover for something else. And the fact that it was Amit Shah's son, I felt that it was how more obvious could it be where the next step is going to. But then somehow, I'm speculating, is that, you know, Sourav Ganguly's recent health problems, his heart attacks and stuff, I think they're linked to an enormous amount of stress that he's going through. I mean, he's a fit guy. I mean, come on. I mean, in terms of he's a professional cricket player. He used to play there. And this is not something which is normal. This is happening, I believe, because of the immense stress that he's under. And because I think he's in the horns of a dilemma. Should he go full-fledged with BJP? And so somebody might ask, so what's the tension here? I mean, he's already showed his hand. He might as well go for it. And again, he might as well go for it today. I have no idea what he's going to say in the interview with Arnab Goswami. But I still think that he's not going to go for it. If he had, then they would have possibly announced it already, or he would have been in the Modi rally, or maybe he's going to appear as a surprise. I don't know. I have no idea what's going on. I can't even predict. But I think that boat might have sailed for Sourav Ganguly to formally join the BJP. Because if he joins the BJP, he has to join it as a chief ministerial candidate. And he's the person when, again, because of the kind of status he has, which is much different from what Mithun Chakraborty has. For one reason, Mithun Chakraborty is old. So, you know, Sourav Ganguly is more an icon of people who are really dynamic and are still in like kind of the dynamic voting age. So Sourav Ganguly is, first of all, younger. Sourav Ganguly has, you know, anybody would look at Sourav Ganguly and said, look, he's leader stuff. I mean, he's led. He took an Indian cricket team which was devastated by match fixing. And he fundamentally changed the very nature of the way Indian cricket is played. And this is not something which, you know, I'm saying, a lot of people have recognized that. And, you know, he removed parochialism from the team, you know, in a time when essentially selectors and the regions they came from decided who got to play, and the best players didn't play. And he inspired a kind of loyalty. If you even look at the pronouncements that Yuvraj or Harbhajan make, you know, the kind of loyalty they still have for Sourav Ganguly. It's not an easy thing to get. I mean, it shows that you have leadership. So in terms of being a leader, Sourav Ganguly has it. He's one of them. I mean, Sourav Ganguly, Mahendra Singh Dhoni, these people are natural leaders. And I honestly feel that neither of them should stop being a leader just because they're no longer in cricket. So the country should definitely use their leadership qualities. And these two people are, I wouldn't say that for Virat Kohli, by the way, but these two people are definitely true leaders. And so with Sourav Ganguly, I always felt that this was, but again, the reason why he is hesitant, I would again say, is because it's the BJP. Because he is, in a way, I think that in a fundamental way, he doesn't buy into the core ideology. He wants to be the chief minister. He just doesn't want the BJP. That's the only reason that I can think of that he's kind of vacillating. He also knows that if he loses, he will basically, and if he's the public face of the BJP, he'll have to essentially, his image in Bengal will have to fall on his, I mean, he'll have basically have to fall on his sword at that point of time, because there's no way that Mamata Banerjee is going to let him go after that. So he's a lucrative personality. He has his own very popular show. He has a lot of business interests in Bengal. So he stands to lose all of them if, you know, if this doesn't work out, if the BJP loses. So it's not just a question of, do I really believe in the BJP? I mean, I'm not a Boy Scout. I don't think that, you know, people who want to be leaders, honestly, they don't think of these things. It's only, you know, mediocre middle-class people like me who think of ideology and philosophy and whether I agree to something. And that's why I am where I am. I don't think that leaders or people who actually do something with their life actually think on these lines. But they definitely think of risk and benefit. I honestly believe that successful people are people who are consistently able to delineate the risks and the benefits and are able to take decisions. It's not, unless you're Rahul Gandhi, who's basically won the genetic lottery. You know, successful people, they consistently take a pattern of good decisions. And you can't just say, oh God, they were lucky. And nobody's lucky all the time. It's just that they take better decisions. They understand risk better than you do. They are more objective in the analysis of risk benefits. And I think that Ganguly has done a lot of risk benefit analysis, which has, I think, brought on some of his health problems, because it's obviously an extremely stressful decision. And he knows that he might be losing the opportunity of his life. I mean, it's happened to Jyoti Basu, and he could have been a chief minister and he took the wrong decision. And it might have already happened to Sourav Ganguly. He could be a chief minister and he's already taken the wrong decision. But whatever it is, I would be very interested to see what happens moving forth. Again, to conclude, who will win? I'm not a brave man enough to make a prediction as to who will win. Vivek, a very brave man. I still think that Mamata Banerjee will be the next chief minister. I think that despite BJP's great game, despite the fact that, yes, BJP has managed to do things that I personally could never have anticipated. I mean, Jai Shri Ram on the roads, people, you know, saffron flags all over Calcutta. I mean, these are things which I, you know, anybody who's grown up in Calcutta in the 90s cannot believe something like this happening. But the world has changed. Definitely the world has changed. The BJP has made enormous progress in Bengal, and is definitely a force, is definitely here to stay. But whether they can win this election, I'm still not sure. They might, again, they might, because Trinamool Congress has their structural problems. BJP has basically taken the Trinamool Congress from underneath them in the same way that Mamata Banerjee once did to the Marxists. But I still think that there's sufficient cement and iron and bricks left still in the Trinamool edifice to repulse this assault. And I know that the assault is severe. I mean, if you have Mithun Chakravarti, and if you have Arnav Goswami, and if you have, you know, the foot soldiers, and you have Mukul Roy, and you can see that, you know, changes have been made. For instance, Mamata Banerjee deciding to run in Nandigram. I mean, she's always fought her battles. I mean, she's changed her seats. I mean, when she started out, she used to, and the only time I've ever voted in an election was, again, when Mamata Banerjee was running for MP from our constituency, and I voted for her. She was then in Congress. So, you know, she's been running in Bhawanipur, which is a very prestigious, you know, assembly seat, which was once held by Siddhartha Shankar Rai. It's a very, but, you know, inexplicably decided not to run there. And because the main reason, I would say, is because it is a very strong Gujarati Marwari population. And that's why I think she thinks, and she thinks it's not a safe seat for her anymore with the BJP. So that shows something. It shows that she's really worried, and maybe it's not her decision. I can't think of Mamata Banerjee, you know, if she was left after her, she would run away from a fight. I think this is Prashant Kishore or somebody, and she's kind of, or, you know, Abhishek basically telling her, and she's doing it. But she's gone to Nandigram. She's gone to Nandigram, which is a strong minority population. She thinks that she has the numbers on her side, but that she's up against Shubhendu Adhikari, who's really the guy who actually led the battle in. So it's a great contest.
I think it's she's in for a fight of her life there because of the constituency she's chosen. And I also felt that, I also feel that she shouldn't have chosen that constituency. She shouldn't have gone up against Shivendu Adhikari. And I think that she's doing it because a part of Mamata Banerjee has that. And this is something which goes beyond pure reason to thumos or glory. You know, that and the BJP is going to use this. Because I don't think that, you know, Amit Shah thinks on those lines. But from Trinamool Congress's slogan, which is Khala Hobe, which means basically, let's play the game now. You know, that this whole thing, there just seems to be a kind of bravado here. And I think Mamata Banerjee shouldn't have taken this step from her perspective. She took this step because, yes, she thinks she has a good chance, a much better chance of winning Nandigram than she thinks Bhavanipur. But she also wants to show, you know, she's mortally hurt emotionally by these people who have left her, the Mukuls and the Shubhendus, and she wants to basically decimate them in their own den. It's just to show to everybody that, you know, this state belongs to me. And I think that, you know, this sounds great in a movie. This sounds great in the climax where the music starts to play and, you know, Mamata Banerjee comes out and says, all right, let's have justice by combat. You know, but, you know, in real life, when you're playing against Amit Shah, I mean, he wants you to do this. And I think she's done exactly what Amit Shah wanted her to do, which is to take on Shivendu Adhikari in Nandigram. It firstly allows him to say that she ran away from Bhavanipur. So she didn't gain any of, I mean, she lost a few bravery points by doing this. If it was only going to be a show of bravery, then she already lost that. And then she'd have taken a much safer seat. There were much safer seats where she would win in a canter in Bengal. And then she's contesting only one election and she's doing it against Shubhendu Adhikari in Nandigram. Yes, what does she gain from this? I don't know. That Shubhendu Adhikari is a no one if she wins. It doesn't really show much. But what does she stand to lose? Everything. If she loses her seat, she stands to lose everything. Even if Trinamool Congress wins. So I think that, again, that the risk that she's taking is not worth the benefit that it will get her. But let's see. Time will say. So thanks a lot, everybody, for listening. Please send me your comments. And please don't forget to be a patron. So it's a monthly contribution that you can make to support this podcast. Please consider becoming a monthly patron. Patronships begin at $1 a month. So thank you, everybody. And please do send in your feedback through email or through Twitter or Facebook or however you want to. And have a nice week. Bye-bye.